Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open with the latest developments and efforts to contain a Newcastle disease outbreak in Ramona. And then, we'll take you to the newly reopened Magnolia Performing Arts Center in El Cajon, where the grand opening entertainment included a duet with the city's piano-playing Mayor Wells. A valley in Potrero once sought by Blackwater as a paramilitary camp has been purchased by a hemp farmer. And we'll have a look back today on the battle to keep that valley green. Susan Davis' announced plans to resign from Congress has prompted a slew of potential candidates to step forward, including East County activist Ray Lutz, City Council President Georgette Gomez, and more. Learn about all those eyeing the seat on today's show. We'll also have news about a Muslim group calling for a congressional investigation into Duncan Hunter for alleged war crimes. Now, before you fire up the barbecue this weekend, listen up. There's a recall on raw beef products unfit for consumption. On Crime Beat, hear about local church leaders indicted for a forced labor scheme preying on homeless people. Then on Green Scene, learn about major steps taken by the county toward a cleaner, greener future, including a community choice energy option for residents. Federal health officials have issued a dire warning urging people to stop vaping all e-cigarette products after more deaths and hundreds of sudden severe lung illnesses. El Cajon is considering banning sales of vaping, and we'll have details. County supervisors have moved to a new meeting location due to remodeling. And then on People Power, hear about efforts by Julian residents to create a town square with an amphitheater. Plus, learn how local water agency crews have been helping restore water service to fire survivors in Paradise, California. We'll have some national news from Public News Service, including Trump administration efforts to indict a former FBI official and to weaken clean water regulations. Locally, hear about changes by the sheriff aimed at preventing jail suicides and the buzz over health concerns about invasive mosquitoes in our region. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
A state investigation has found that infected birds moved from a virulent Newcastle disease quarantine area in Riverside County led to the recent detection of the disease in Ramona, Dr. Annette Jones, California state veterinarian, has announced. Moving birds within a quarantine area or taking them to an area outside the quarantine zone is illegal. Violators are subject to fines from $100 to $1,000 or up to $25,000 if a violator is proven to have moved the virus. Ramona was the first San Diego County location found to be harboring the dreaded disease during the current Southern California outbreak. On Facebook, some local residents voiced anger after learning that their birds died because of a person who illegally moved infected birds, and they called for the state to impose hefty fines on the violator. Jones praised the rapid actions of responsible poultry owners in Ramona, as well as state and federal agricultural departments for helping to contain the outbreak. While testing and surveillance continues, Jones says authorities are hopeful that the response team may have confined the virus to a small area. Exposed birds may appear healthy, she noted, yet could be in early stages of the infection and highly contagious to other birds. Mandatory killing of infected and exposed poultry related to the current incident has occurred in both San Diego and Riverside counties. The quarantine also includes parts of San Bernardino and Los Angeles counties, where the disease has been found earlier. While euthanasia is economically hard and stressful for bird owners, it's the only way to prevent spread once an outbreak occurs. Not taking action could cause far more bird deaths, since the disease is 90% fatal in chickens and threatens other poultry. The good news is that cases have dropped sharply in recent months as response teams continue to seek out small pockets of infection with community help to eradicate the disease in California. Bird owners are urged to be aware of VND signs, practice good biosecurity, and report sick birds promptly by calling the Sick Bird Hotline at 866-922-2473. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is Miriam Raftery with some additional updates on Newcastle disease in Ramona. At a town hall this week at the Ramona Library, state and federal agricultural officials confirmed that between 50 and 100 birds at 8 properties have been killed in Ramona due to exposure to the disease, which was found at an antibodies laboratory. Authorities have not released the name of the lab due to security concerns after a reported death threat against a veterinarian who reported the case to state health officials. One lab has gone so far as to scrub information about its research involving chickens off its website. Newcastle disease is fatal 90% of the time in chickens and can cause severe neurological damage in survivors. Authorities have been conducting testing of additional birds in the vicinity. The good news is that no more birds have tested positive, and authorities voice hope that the outbreak may be contained. Ramona residents are asked not to move birds out of the neighborhood affected and to practice biosecurity measures, including sanitizing shoes and vehicle tires of everyone visiting their property. Residents are also asked to report any dead birds by calling 866-922-2473.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight. Community members from across the region flocked to the grand opening of the Magnolia Performing Arts Center in downtown El Cajon on Tuesday. More than $8 million has been spent remodeling the former East County Performing Arts Center, which was closed for a decade but now blossomed anew. Live Nation offered tours to the public and press, along with free foods from local vendors, ranging from tamales to grilled corn, plus prize giveaways, including tickets to upcoming concerts. The company has hired 100 staffers, including 89 El Cajon residents. As the setting sun sent a starburst shining through a newly planted magnolia tree out front, visitors inside saw renovations including a remodeled lobby, new VIP lounge, bars, revamped backstage dressing rooms, theater seats with drink holders, and more. A new gold curtain rose on entertainment that included a professional pianist, as well as a duet of Hallelujah, performed by local vocalist Stephanie Noriega and El Cajon's own Mayor Bill Wells, playing piano and singing. Mayor Wells likened seeing the restored Magnolia Center to rediscovering an old friend all grown up. He said, "The Magnolia is now the best it's ever been," adding, "The chess piece that made it all work was Live Nation, coming on and working with us." Councilman Phil Ortiz recalled his brother, now a Broadway performer, getting his start in show business on the Magnolia's stage. Councilman Bob McClellan recalled early doubts about whether the theater should be saved due to the high cost of renovations needed, but voiced gratitude to see it finally reopened. Councilman Steve Goble thanked everyone involved. The city issued a proclamation declaring September 10th Live Nation Day. Live Nation representative Eric Berghammer then presented the city with a guitar, striking a harmonious chord for the future. The restored Performing Arts Center, long known as a jewel in our region for its excellent acoustics, will be available for rentals on dates when Live Nation is not utilizing the facility, including outdoor patio space, the theater itself, and the new VIP lounge. Shows for the season include headliners ranging from folk music icon Art Garfunkel to comedian Kathleen Madigan, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Dave Mason, Latin star Ramon Ayala, pop music icon Patti LaBelle, and many more. You can find the full lineup and get tickets at MagnoliaSanDiego.com.
A former chicken ranch in Potrero that sparked a firestorm of controversy when Blackwater sought to acquire it to build a paramilitary training camp a dozen years ago has been sold to Green Hygienics Holdings, an industrial hemp cultivation company. The 824-acre Potrero ranch land and buildings will be utilized to grow industrial hemp for cannabidiol, or CBD, cultivation. Jan Hedlund, the Potrero Planning Group member who led a community effort to halt Blackwater from disrupting the town's rural tranquility with paramilitary and firearms training, informed our show's producer of the sale in an email with the subject line, "New Neighbors." Green Hygienics confirmed its acquisition in a press release, calling the valley an ideal location for industrial hemp for CBD cultivation. The company plans to apply for USDA organic certification. Green Hygienics cites the area's abundant water supply, soil type, altitude, and flat arable land that's sheltered by surrounding mountains as assets. In addition to cultivating the soil, the company has begun converting over 400,000 square feet of outbuildings, including chicken coops, into greenhouses, which will allow multiple harvests each year. Many Potrero residents may think it's high time to see a new owner committing to a property use that's consistent with the site's agricultural zoning, instead of a private military contractor creating noise, traffic, safety, and environmental concerns. Blackwater's plans drew massive protests back in 2007, including a march through the adjacent Hauser Wilderness led by environmental organizations that wanted to keep the site green, as well as peace groups and other activists concerned over Blackwater's controversial actions in Iraq. The Potrero community's battle against Blackwater drew international media attention, with reporters from CNN, The New York Times, and the BBC all visiting Potrero to cover the story of a small town standing up to a Goliath company known as the world's largest private mercenary army, according to journalist and author Jeremy Scahill, who wrote a book about Blackwater. In October 2007, the Harris Fire scorched Potrero and the valley coveted by Blackwater, belying a Blackwater vice president's boast that the site would never burn. In fact, it already had the night before, as news photos published at the time proved. Blackwater offered relief to fire survivors, including setting up a military tent with cots. But the proud people of Potrero refused to accept charity from Blackwater. Instead, the townspeople organized a successful recall election to oust all five community planners who voted for the Blackwater project, retaining only Jan Hedlund. A few months later, in spring 2008, Blackwater abruptly announced cancellation of its plans, citing high cost of noise abatement. But many believed that massive protests, negative publicity, and a wildfire fueled by hurricane-force winds may have dissuaded Blackwater from putting a bunkhouse with 200 men and a city block-sized flammable ammunition storage facility in the Box Canyon. Residents celebrated news that the agricultural property would not be converted into a paramilitary training ground, though its future remained uncertain at the time. Some feared it might be converted to a massive energy project or a housing development, although it was zoned agricultural. Martin Eder, the founder of Activist San Diego, called the acquisition of Potrero Ranch by a hemp and CBD cultivator poetic justice. He was involved in that struggle to stop Blackwater from purchasing the property before founding KNSJ Radio. Eder says, in many senses, the two corporations seemed to be polar opposites. Blackwater was the world's largest private mercenary army embroiled in running security in the dirty war in Iraq and accused of ruthlessly killing innocent civilians. The cannabis industry is associated with peace, love, and good vibes, he says. Eder recalls that when Blackwater tried to buy its way into Potrero to set up a training camp at the ranch, promising jobs and community benefits, it led to what he calls an epic battle between the peace movement and the billion-dollar corporate giant. But Eder sounds a cautionary note on the new owners of Potrero Ranch. It behooves all of us, most particularly Potrero residents, to monitor any corporate interests, he states. This is not a mom-and-pop backyard victory garden being proposed. This could be a massive project that would affect the water table and the peaceful quality of life in the backcountry. Indeed, well water usage is a concern raised by some in Potrero, a rural town where wells and groundwater are vital to sustain residents, livestock, and agriculture, though the project could also bring jobs to the backcountry. The site has been used in the past to graze cattle and raise poultry. It's also a haven for wildlife. Golden eagles and mountain lions have been known to frequent the site. Now it will remain agricultural, growing California's newest legal cash crop, industrial hemp. The Hemp Farming Act of 2018, passed by Congress, removed hemp from Schedule I controlled substances. Industrial hemp contains less than 0.3% THC, the active ingredient in cannabis or marijuana. New California regulations allowing industrial hemp growing became legal this past April, with yet another bill signed into law just this week by Governor Gavin Newsom. Industrial hemp cultivation is now legal in San Diego County, as long as commercial growers register with the County Department of Agriculture before cultivating, in accordance with state law. While Green Hygienics plans to sell its industrial hemp for use in CBD products, hemp has a long history of use in a wide range of other things. According to the Columbia History of the World, the oldest relic of human industry is a scrap of hemp fabric dating back to 8,000 BC. Presidents Washington and Jefferson grew hemp, and during the colonial era and early years of our nation, Americans were actually legally bound to grow hemp, which was used in items as diverse as ropes on American ships to paper. In 1937, a tax act restricting marijuana also made hemp cultivation difficult for U.S. farmers. The tide shifted back toward growers during World War II, however, when the U.S. Department of Agriculture even produced a film called Hemp for Victory, encouraging farmers to grow hemp, and the government subsidized the hemp crops. The industry faded away again after the war, and in 1970, the Controlled Substances Act lumped hemp in with marijuana, banning its use in cultivation, until the 2018 legislation once again restored the rights of farmers to grow industrial hemp. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
After Democratic Congresswoman Susan Davis announced that she will be retiring at the end of her term, numerous potential candidates are eyeing running to fill her seat in the 53rd Congressional District, which includes much of San Diego as well as East County communities, notably parts of La Mesa, El Cajon, Lemon Grove, and Spring Valley. Democratic contenders include Ray Lutz, founder of the nonprofit watchdog group Citizens Oversight in El Cajon. He has formed an exploratory committee for a possible run. Lutz ran against Duncan Hunter in 2008, but now lives in Davis District due to redistricting. Lutz and the organization he founded have been instrumental in attaining some landmark actions, including a lawsuit that won $775 million for SDG&E ratepayers, a successful fight to save East County's Performing Arts Center, a battle to keep Blackwater out of San Diego's backcountry, and a fight for safer storage of nuclear waste at San Onofre. Lutz has also organized a series of Earth Summit events focused on climate change issues. Another candidate is Georgette Gomez, president of the San Diego City Council. She has also formed an exploratory committee. Housing and transportation have been key issues for her, and she's also chaired the Metropolitan Transit Systems Board. Sarah Jacobs, nonprofit leader and member of Qualcomm founder Irwin Jacobs' family, has announced her candidacy for the seat. She previously ran in the 49th district race, won by fellow Democrat Mike Levine. Her website states that she has served in the U.S. State Department during the Obama administration, as well as at UNICEF and the United Nations. Jose Caballero is a retired nuclear engineer with the U.S. Navy, and he's the founder of the San Diego Progressive Democratic Club. He also runs a political consulting firm. Yet another Democratic candidate is Joaquin Vasquez, son of undocumented immigrants who overcame family separation and homelessness to obtain a master's degree in public policy. He's worked on the Obama campaign and community activism, focused on civil and human rights, public education, economic inequality, environmental, immigration, and refugee issues. The San Diego Union-Tribune reports that Lemon Grove Mayor Raquel Vasquez, the first African-American woman mayor in our county, has also voiced interest in possibly running for the seat. So far, the only Republican in the race is Pamela Ramos, a nurse and healthcare nonprofit founder who announced plans to switch from running against Congressman Scott Peters in the 52nd District and instead run in the 53rd. There is no legal requirement for a congressional member to live in the district that they represent. The 53rd District is heavily Democratic, with roughly twice as many Democrats as Republicans. Susan Davis won her last race in 2018 with a solid 70% of the vote, and will now retire after nearly two decades in Congress. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. A Muslim group is asking the House to formally investigate and censure Congressman Duncan Hunter for alleged war crimes. On September 9th, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, delivered a petition with 8,000 signatures to Speaker Nancy Pelosi. CARE also held a press conference outside of Hunter's El Cajon office. The nonprofit is the largest Muslim civil liberties and advocacy organization in the U.S. Hunter, who represents the 50th Congressional District, has already been stripped of his committee assignments as he faces 60 federal charges of misusing campaign donations for personal use and filing false reports to cover up those alleged crimes. However, CARE San Diego Executive Director Dustin Cron says lawmakers are overlooking Hunter's worst deeds. He says the worst thing about him is that he's actually a self-admitted war criminal. And he adds, if you admitted to killing perhaps hundreds of civilians and that's not a big deal, what world do we live in when it comes to investigating war criminals? That should be a bipartisan reality. Now, the accusations of Hunter committing war crimes during his 3 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan stem from 2 admissions that he made while speaking out in defense of former Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher. Gallagher was later found not guilty of murdering a prisoner during wartime, but guilty of posing with the prisoner's body. In an interview with the Zero Blog 30 podcast, Hunter said, "I was an artillery officer, and we fired hundreds of rounds into Fallujah. Killed probably hundreds of civilians, if not scores, if not hundreds of civilians. Probably killed women and children, if there were any left in the city when we invaded. So do I get judged, too?" In addition, at a town hall in San Diego, Hunter said he posed for photos with corpses, which is prohibited in the U.S. Military Code of Justice. The Republican congressman said,
"Eddie did one bad thing that I'm guilty of, too. Taking a picture with the body and saying something stupid."
CARE's petition asked for formal action over Hunter's admission of participating in the killing of hundreds of civilians and posing with corpses, quote, as if they were hunting trophies, unquote. In his 2018 race against Democrat Omar Campanajar, Hunter was accused of running the most anti-Muslim campaign in the country because he repeatedly tried to tie his opponent to terrorism and attacked his Palestinian heritage, even though Campanajar is Catholic. Hunter claimed in one attack ad that Campanajar accepted campaign contributions from CARE to infiltrate Congress. However, Campanajar did not receive any money from the organization, according to campaign finance reports, and as a nonprofit, CARE cannot endorse or donate to candidates. In response to the petition, Hunter's office released a statement which reads, "For several years, the local chapter of CARE has attempted to malign Congressman Hunter with these types of orchestrated stunts in an effort to provide political support for their endorsed candidates, one of which is currently running against Congressman Hunter." That's Campanajar, and again, he is not endorsed by CARE. "This approach hasn't worked in the past," Hunter says, "and it will not work now for the simple reason that anti-Semitic organizations that openly support terrorism warrant zero attention and have zero credibility." Cron pushed back on the claims made in Hunter's statement, denying that CARE supports terrorism or is anti-Semitic. He accused the congressman of being Islamophobic, stating, "At the root of that is the fact that he is clearly very comfortable killing Muslims and then bragging about it." Cron says Speaker Pelosi's office suggested the group submit its complaints about Hunter to the Committee on Government Oversight, which CARE says it plans to do soon.
This is Jonathan Getz with a health alert. American Beef Packers, Inc., a California-based company, is recalling nearly 25,000 pounds of raw beef products deemed unfit for human consumption, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service has announced. The raw beef items were produced and packaged on August 21st. They include American Beef Packers boneless beef, boneless beef chucks, ribeye steaks, boneless sirloins, tenderloins, and more. The products subject to recall bear establishment number EST34741 inside the USDA mark of inspection. These items were shipped to federal establishments in California and Oregon. If you have these products in your freezer or refrigerator, you should return them to the place of purchase for a refund or throw them out.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Fisteer with a Crime Beat report. Indictments unsealed in federal court reveal that a dozen leaders of the Imperial Valley Ministries Church, including the former pastor, have been charged with forced labor, conspiracy, document servitude, and benefits fraud. The victims were mostly homeless people in San Diego and Imperial counties. Church leaders arrested Tuesday included Jose Chito Morales of San Diego, and Pastor Victor Gonzalez, as well as others in El Centro and in Brownsville, Texas. Prosecutors allege that victims were forced to surrender welfare benefits and to panhandle up to 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, to benefit church leaders financially. U.S. Attorney Robert Brewer in San Diego says, "The indictment alleges an appalling abuse of power by church officials who preyed on vulnerable homeless people with promises of a warm bed and meals. These victims were held captive, stripped of their humble financial means, their identification, their freedom, and their dignity." FBI Special Agent in Charge Scott Brunner says human trafficking robs victims of their most basic human rights. Victims of human trafficking are often unseen by society, left pleading in silence, he adds. Imperial Valley Ministries, or IVM, operates a non-denominational church headquartered in El Centro and has opened around 30 affiliate churches throughout the United States and Mexico, including locations in Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and San Jose in California, as well as Nevada, Arizona, and Texas. IVM's stated purpose is to restore drug addicts at faith-based rehabilitation group homes and raise money to open other churches in other cities to do the same. In addition to the church and main office, IVM owned and operated 3 group homes in the El Centro area, plus one in Calexico and another in Chula Vista. Many victims were recruited from outside of El Centro, including San Diego. IVM leaders allegedly induced many to participate with offers of food and shelter, with the false promise that victims would be provided with resources to eventually return home. According to the indictment, defendants checked in victims at IVM group homes, where they were required to sign agreements to adhere to rules. Many victims, including some who did not require drug rehabilitation services, claimed they were later held against their will. The indictment alleges that church leaders locked victims inside group homes with deadbolt locks, confiscated IDs such as driver's licenses and immigration papers to prevent victims from escaping, stole victims' welfare benefits, EBT cards, and personal property. They also required adherence to rules that required them to read the Bible and prohibited them from discussing matters of the world or obtaining outside employment. Prosecutors say that windows were nailed shut at some group homes, leading a desperate 17-year-old victim to break a window, escape, and run to a neighboring property to call police. Church leaders refused to return the confiscated EBT cards and personal property to participants who asked to leave, prosecutors allege. To coerce victims into panhandling and prevent them from leaving the church, the church leaders also allegedly threatened to take away victims' children. Some were told that loved ones had rejected them. Punishments for violating the rules, reportedly including withholding food and even denying medicine to a diabetic victim with low blood sugar. Fortunately, she escaped and got help. All of the identified victims are now free. If any additional victims come forward, they will be provided immediate help with shelter, transportation, and other support, the U.S. Attorney's Office indicates. Brewer states, "This is the most significant labor trafficking prosecution in this district in many years. These cases are far and few between because many victims live in captivity and fear, powerless to report the crimes against them." He adds, "My office wants victims to know that we are here to help you. You can report suspicions of labor trafficking by calling the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. If you or someone you know is a victim of human trafficking, help can be found by calling the National Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-888-373-7888.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Gene Carpenter with a health alert. 450 cases of severe lung illness and 5 deaths are now linked to vaping. The public health crisis has spread to 33 states, including California, where one death has occurred. Locally, San Diego County health officials report 11 cases. Most of the severe lung illness cases have occurred in previously healthy young people between ages 18 and 25. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control has issued a warning advising the public to avoid all vaping, also known as e-cigarette smoking, e-hookah, or juuling. The warning includes all forms of vaping, including nicotine and marijuana. While most cases involve people who vaped cannabis products sold on the black market, some had used only nicotine-based products. Authorities believe chemicals are responsible, but no single cause has yet been found. Those who ignore the warning to stop vaping are advised to seek medical attention immediately if they experience shortness of breath, coughing, chest pain, nausea, or vomiting. If you are concerned about your health after using an e-cigarette product, you can also call your local poison control center at 1-800-222-1222. If you need help to stop smoking, the CDC recommends that you talk with a physician and choose FDA-approved options other than vaping. Parents are advised to talk to teens about dangers of vaping, which many young people believe is harmless. In fact, it can affect brain development in adolescents, also putting them at risk of severe lung disease, addiction, and long-term risks of cancer, according to the CDC. The CDC urges medical professionals to report all possible cases of e-cigarette-related pulmonary disease to local and state health departments, take a detailed history of substances used by the patient, and obtain any devices and liquids used for testing by health authorities.
El Cajon's City Council will consider a ban or other restrictions on sales of vaping products, such as banning flavored vapes, at its October 8th meeting at 3 p.m., Councilman Gary Kendrick, who asked that the issue be added to the agenda, says, "I may take some heat for this, but it's the right thing to do." The action comes amid a public health crisis in which 5 deaths and 450 cases of severe lung damage nationwide have been linked to vaping. Increasingly, governmental entities are cracking down on sales of these products, also called e-cigarettes, e-hookahs, and juuling. In June, San Francisco banned sales of all e-cigarettes. Last week, Michigan became the first state to outlaw sales of flavored e-cigarettes, including retail and online purchases. And now the Trump administration this week has announced plans to ban sales of all flavored vaping products nationwide. Although the illnesses and deaths are suspected to be caused by chemicals in tobacco-based vapes as well as in illegal marijuana vaping products, federal health officials are also concerned with stopping the alarming growth in young people smoking e-cigarettes. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says, "We will not stand idly by as these products become an on-ramp to combustible cigarettes or nicotine addiction for a generation of youth." The federal action has been praised by health officials, but criticized by the American Vaping Association, which states a ban will remove life-changing options from the market that have been used by several million American adults to quit smoking. But the Centers for Disease Control has called for all Americans to quit vaping amid the rising deaths and illnesses linked to e-cigarettes. Moreover, the agency is now advising that smokers wishing to quit smoking cigarettes consult their doctors and choose FDA-approved methods instead of vaping, undercutting the vaping industry's main argument for keeping its products legal. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Goetz with the Green Scene Report. San Diego County's first Climate Action Plan update report is in and confirms that the county is on track to meet 2020 greenhouse gas reduction targets. The county cut over 100,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide between 2014 and 2018, That's 78% of the county's goal for reducing CO2 by 2020. Supervisors approved the Climate Action Plan in February 2018 to shrink greenhouse gas emissions in the county's unincorporated communities and in county facilities through 26 measures, including reducing air pollution and waste, increasing water efficiency, conserving agricultural and open space, planting thousands of local trees, and improving access to sustainable transportation, such as electric vehicles. The plan's environmental impact report is being challenged in court. However, with the physical effects of climate change becoming increasingly evident, the report states the county is continuing to implement its plan to cut greenhouse gases and meet state goals. Some of the actions taken so far include: the county's Planning and Development Services Department has waived fees and issued solar rooftop permits for over 38,000 homes since 2014. The county generated over 6,000 megawatts of solar power at county-owned facilities last year, enough electricity to power over 500 homes for a year. The county has helped install over 7,000 discount rain barrels to cut residential water use and reduce energy used to pump and treat water. Through 2018, the county has planted 13,930 trees, just 70 trees short of 2020's target. The county has cut energy use at its 430 county-owned facilities by 20%, exceeding 2020 goals, and cut fuel emissions from the county's fleet of nearly 4,000 vehicles by 11%, also exceeding the 2020 goal. Through 2018, the county has acquired over 3,000 acres of conservation land, exceeding the 2020 target. County officials say the Climate Action Plan is reducing greenhouse gas emissions while also protecting the unincorporated county's suburban, semi-rural, and rural character. The plan was created with input from residents and over 50 environmental, business, and community stakeholder groups in more than 100 public workshops and other events.
County supervisors voted 3-2 on Tuesday to continue exploring the idea of getting into the business of buying and selling electricity through a community choice energy program. Supervisors Kristen Gaspar and Jim Desmond opposed the motion. The action came after a feasibility study was presented to the board, along with a business plan. Community choice programs allow cities and counties to buy and/or generate electricity for residents and businesses. So a county-run community choice program would offer those in the county's unincorporated areas an alternative to buying power from SDG&E. SDG&E would still provide transmission lines and delivery services. Currently, the City of Solana Beach is the only operating community choice program in our county. But the City of San Diego is working to form a Regional Joint Powers Authority, or JPA, with the cities of La Mesa, Encinitas, Chula Vista, and maybe more. Other local cities have completed feasibility studies or plan to start one soon. The county's feasibility report found that a community choice option would provide 90% clean, renewable energy by 2030 and save the average residential customer about $2 a month on their bill. Several governance options were considered, including the county operating on its own, forming a joint powers authority or JPA with other local cities, or joining the City of San Diego's regional JPA. All three options would allow for launching community choice in 2021. Tuesday's action directed staff at the county to negotiate a JPA with potential city partners. Staff was asked to return to the board with an ordinance and JPA agreement on October 15th. The action comes after a series of workshops and public forums at which the county sought input from ratepayers, consumer groups, utility representatives, and local cities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The County Board of Supervisors will hold its next 12 board meetings at the County Operations Center in Kearny Mesa while the downtown chamber undergoes renovation. Meetings will begin at 9 a.m. Live videos of the proceedings are also available online, and the meetings are archived several hours later on the supervisor's webpage. The board is expected to resume meetings at the County Administration Center downtown on January the 20th, after the renovations are completed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter. This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
A long vacant lot in the heart of historic downtown Julian may soon become a town square with an amphitheater and community park to serve as a hub for community gatherings, holiday events, a farmer's market, an art walk, and more. Over $182,000, nearly a third of the $600,000 needed, have been pledged already, according to the Julian Town Square website. Funding includes individual donations, money raised at a community fundraiser, as well as corporate contributions. That includes money from Chevron, which paid to help clean up the site at Main Street in Washington that has been vacant since a gas station was torn down there in 1989. The site previously housed a hotel, shops, and a sheriff station at various points in Julian's past. Now, the Julian Community Heritage Foundation is asking for public help from visitors outside of Julian to help make their dream become a reality. The foundation has applied to the state for nonprofit status. For now, they have partnered up with Community Action Service and Advocacy as a fiscal sponsor on the project, so that donations made through a GoFundMe page for the Julian Town Square are tax-deductible. The group has drawn up preliminary town square designs, which have been presented to the County Board of Supervisors. Leaders are negotiating with the property owner for purchase of the lot, and a local marketing company has volunteered to create a marketing campaign for the ambitious project. The idea is supported by the Julian Chamber of Commerce and the Julian Historical Society, as well as the San Diego Backcountry Visitors Bureau. To learn more or to make a donation, you can visit juliantownsquare.com. Reporting from Julian for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Gene Carpenter with a People Power Report. The wildfire that killed 85 people last year in Paradise, California, burned down nearly the entire town, destroying over 19,000 structures. It also left more than 10,000 residents without water because it was deemed unfit to drink. The fire burned through pipes and also contaminated most water mains with chemicals. So Helix and Padre Water Districts in San Diego's East County have joined with other water agencies around the state to help restore drinking water to many residents in the Northern California community. Now some Paradise residents can turn on their tap for the first time in over 8 months and have clean water to drink, bathe, and brush teeth. Last month, Paradise's water district was able to restore water quality in most of its water mains, and the focus shifted to helping individual customers test their water and, if contaminated, replace their water lines with a little help from some friends. It's all part of the California Water Wastewater Agency Response Network set up through the state's Office of Emergency Services, a system that makes residents in fire-ravaged Paradise, in one sense, more fortunate than those living in Flint, Michigan, where many residential water pipes remain contaminated with lead that makes their water still toxic to drink. Dan Baker from Helix Water led the local team in Paradise, where many residents are still living in trailers waiting to rebuild. He says, "If you closed your eyes, all you heard were friendly people. Everyone in town was very positive, but when you looked around, there were trucks and workers everywhere, rebuilding." At the end of July, the California Department of Resources, Recycling, and Recovery that they had removed 75% of the structural debris from the campfire in Paradise and Butte County, including 1.6 million tons of ash and debris, over 518,000 tons of concrete, 37,000 tons of metal, and over 446,000 tons of contaminated soil. On August 6, Paradise residents gathered to hear the progress reports from local and state agencies involved in rebuilding the community. The California Office of Emergency Services is developing a plan to remove the hazardous trees still standing. The town is opening a resource center to streamline the permitting process for residents rebuilding their homes, and the school district has made sure the new school year began on schedule. But a safe water supply is still an issue. The water distribution system was contaminated during the fire with benzene, a known carcinogen. Fire officials believe that the system depressurized during the fire and sucked in a toxic mix of gases from burning homes. This also happened in Santa Rosa during the Tubbs Fire in 2017. Paradise Irrigation reported to residents on October 6 that the district lifted water advisories on 133 of the homes still standing and is testing and restoring water quality at 30 to 50 more standing homes each week. When Helix offered mutual aid assistance through the Office of Emergency Services, the Paradise Water District said it had cleared the gases from their water mains, but could use help testing and restoring water quality in customers' lines. Helix sent Baker along with Brian Waite from its meters and valve section and John Wilson and Eric Hughes from its construction section to provide that help. The local crews headed north for a week, collecting water samples at meters from each standing home and installing a high line to deliver safe water until the sample was tested and the customer service line approved for use. The Helix Padre workers also helped install hundreds of backflow prevention assemblies to prevent contamination from construction throughout the community. The crew took with them to Paradise a California Strong, Paradise Strong banner signed by board members and district employees at both Helix and Padre Dam. After their first day in Paradise, Baker emailed Helix Operations Director Kevin Miller. "There's a lot of work up here, but the town is healing. I think I speak for all four of us when I say I'm proud to be a part of this."
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, September 13th, 2019. I'm Eric Tegedov. Prosecutors get approval to bring charges against former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, and the Trump administration rolls back clean water protections. First, from Washington, D.C., the Department of Justice says prosecutors can bring charges against former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe after his last-ditch effort to have charges against him dropped failed. McCabe is being investigated for lying about his decision to authorize FBI officials to speak to the Wall Street Journal about a Department of Justice investigation into the Clintons. McCabe took over as acting FBI director after President Trump dismissed James Comey in 2017. He became a frequent target of Trump while the agency looked into connections between his campaign and Russian influence on the 2016 election. While the Justice Department has denied McCabe's appeal to drop charges, and there are other signs an indictment could be coming, charges have yet to be announced. The Trump administration announced on Thursday the withdrawal of Obama-era anti-pollution protections for smaller streams, known as the Waters of the United States Rule, or WOTUS. Conservation groups say the rollback could have many implications for the environment, especially in the Southwest. But as Suzanne Potter reports, officials in Nevada don't seem too concerned.
State Attorney General Aaron Ford's statement says, "At this time, Nevada believes it would be in its best interest to remain under the pre-2015 WOTUS rule." Scott Edwards with the nonprofit Food and Water Watch says states are free to raise their standards above the federal level and thinks Nevada is too close to the mining industry.
"The whole Southwest mining industry is not well regulated by the state governments. A lot of the challenges to the Obama 2015 WOTUS rule were coming out of southwestern mining states who didn't like what they claimed was the overreach of the Obama rule."
Climate change is overheating classrooms and hurting education, especially for poor and minority students, according to a new study from UCLA.
Jisung Park led the team that compared standardized test results with weather records. He says for students without proper AC, every added degree means about 1% less learning.
"That may not seem like much, but with the climate change that's coming down the pike without further action, we're talking about 5 to 7 to 10% less learning on average per year."
The fossil fuel industries and their allies in office have said climate change is not real or not a serious problem. He stresses that since school districts across the country have a huge imbalance in what buildings and repairs they can afford, the effect they saw is 2 or 3 times greater for students in poor and minority communities.
That was Dan Hyman reporting. This is PNS. With a mysterious lung illness being linked to use, states in the White House are examining e-cigarettes. Roz Brown has more from South Dakota.
South Dakota's state epidemiologist says he supports a ban on flavored e-cigarettes, a proposal the Trump administration said this week that it's considering. Dr. Joshua Clayton says many people think e-cigarettes are safer than regular cigarettes, even though long-term health effects are unknown. He says teens find the flavored products appealing, but could be setting themselves up for a lifetime addiction to tobacco.
And I think the focus on banning flavored products is a very good step in the right direction, so that we're not using bubblegum flavoring, which is very directed toward the youth population.
On Monday, Clayton confirmed two cases of vaping-related illness in South Dakota among 20 to 24-year-olds. The state joins 33 others reporting cases of severe respiratory illness from e-cigarettes. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says of the hundreds of cases, at least six people have died from the mysterious lung ailment. The Food and Drug Administration is now finalizing guidance to remove all non-tobacco flavors of e-cigarettes, including mint and menthol, from the market within 30 days.
Groups in Virginia are pushing state lawmakers to pass a borrower's bill of rights, just days after a U.S. House hearing at which student debt was called a $1.5 trillion national crisis.
The Virginia bill is designed to protect more than 1 million people who have student debt from what some consider irregular servicing practices. But House Republicans have defeated the bill in the past three General Assembly sessions, according to Anna Scholl, executive director of the group Progress Virginia.
They're very basic protections that would require student loan servicers, for example, to give borrowers what their loan balance is when they ask. They would be prohibited from recklessly misapplying payments. Really basic provisions that, frankly, we don't think should be a burden on the servicers.
A spokesperson for the Student Loan Servicing Alliance says the trade association opposes the bill because it would set up rights that might differ from state to state and could confuse borrowers. I'm Diane Bernard reporting.
And finally, death doulas are part of a growing movement urging a paradigm shift in how death is viewed. Nadia Ramlagan spoke with one in North Carolina.
Durham resident Omi Shade Bernie Scott is a death doula, a non-medical caregiver who assists people at the end of their lives. She sees death caregiving as a ritualist practice, closely linked to the process of giving birth.
I think people may be familiar with birth doulas. A birth doula is an individual who's a non-medical professional who provides support to families in the process of preparing for the birth of a child.
An aging baby boomer population is boosting the demand for death-related services.
I'm Eric Tegedoff for Public News Service. We are member and listener-supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The San Diego County Sheriff's Department announced that it has adopted policies to prevent inmate suicides at its jails. The actions follow a report that decried a shocking number of suicides at local lockup facilities. The study by Disability Rights California, an advocacy agency for the disabled, was released last year, Times of San Diego reports. The report noted that over 30 inmates took their own lives in San Diego area jails and prisons since 2010, a rate that far outpaced other county jail systems in the state. The agency concluded that the shocking number of inmates dying by suicide locally pointed to an urgent need for corrective action by the county. In response to criticism raised by the Disability Rights California study, the county hired Lindsay Hayes, an authority on inmate suicides, to make recommendations. So far, the county has addressed 26 of 32 proposed improvements by Hayes and continues to evaluate the rest, according to the Sheriff's Department. Hayes met with detention services officials, as well as deputies, nurses, and mental health personnel locally, and found that they appeared genuinely concerned about inmate suicide and committed to taking actions to reduce future tragedies. Sheriff's officials noted that to help reduce suicides, the department is developing and implementing programs such as enhanced observation housing and seeking accreditation with the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare. Hayes, a project director with the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives, says the county's efforts have already resulted in a significant decrease in the number of inmate suicides since late 2016. Changes the Sheriff's Department says it made based on Hayes' recommendations include new mandatory suicide prevention and mental health training for employees, better screening and intake procedures to identify those having suicidal thoughts, enhancing monitoring based on individual levels of suicide risk, instituting mental health triage and referral protocols, assigning a facility mental health team to manage treatment needs of suicidal and mentally ill patients, and creating a suicide prevention-focused response team to track self-harm incidents, attempted suicides, and suicides. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Lakeside resident Dennis Richardson was appalled to discover that thousands of yellow fever mosquitoes were breeding in water dishes under potted plants at his house. His grandfather was a sanitation engineer who worked to eradicate yellow fever so that Americans could build the Panama Canal and later battled the yellow fever epidemic in Peru. Richardson says this work was deadly for most who did the work, as most of them got yellow fever. Yellow fever is fatal 20-50% of the time. Its most obvious symptom is yellow eyes and skin or jaundice. Fortunately, this disease is not present in San Diego currently, but it could take hold if one of these yellow fever mosquitoes were to bite a returning traveler with the disease. In the past, yellow fever epidemics have killed thousands of people in U.S. cities, including New Orleans, Memphis, Charleston, and as far north as Boston and Philadelphia. Aedes mosquitoes can also transmit other diseases, such as Zika virus, dengue fever, and chikungunya. Invasive Aedes mosquitoes fly low to the ground and most often bite legs and ankles. They're aggressive, active during the day, and breed in tiny amounts of water, even indoors. Three species of Aedes mosquitoes are now found locally, and they're plaguing residents across East County. They are the Aedes aegypti, or yellow fever mosquito, Aedes aldopictus, or the Asian tiger mosquito, and the Aedes notoscriptus, known as the Aussie mozzie from Australia. Now, it's important to control all mosquitoes since West Nile virus is transmitted by the Culex mosquito, not the Aedes, and West Nile virus is a disease found locally that can be fatal. County Vector Control is conducting aerial larvicide drops on local waterways, and they're asking the public's help to report and eradicate these dangerous and annoying pests. The county will provide a free inspection of your property on request to identify mosquito breeding spots and advice on how to eliminate any mosquitoes found. You can call San Diego County Vector Control at 858-694-2888. A county map shows areas where the Aedes mosquitoes have been found this year in San Diego County, with clusters in the East County communities of Santee, Lakeside, El Cajon, La Mesa, and more. As the weather warms up, reports of mosquito activity are on the rise. The Cajon Valley Union School District sent a letter to parents warning of a sharp increase in mosquito populations and bites. And on the Nextdoor forums in Mount Helix and La Mesa, many residents posted about experiencing these aggressive ankle-biting mosquitoes. To prevent mosquito breeding, dump out and clean containers holding water indoors as well as outdoors at least every week to get rid of the standing water. Be aware that invasive Aedes mosquito eggs, however, can survive without water for months. So fill plant saucers with sand or fine gravel to prevent pools of water from forming. If you collect rainwater, be sure rain barrels are securely screened and sealed to prevent mosquito breeding. A female mosquito can fly over 30 feet down a narrow pipe or a gutter to find water. Aedes mosquitoes prefer to lay eggs in small containers, though, like plant saucers, discarded tires, buckets, watering cans, and even flower vases. Protect yourself from bites by putting screens on windows and doors to keep mosquitoes outside. Wear long sleeves and pants when outdoors to protect against bites, and apply insect repellent that contains DEET, oil of lemon eucalyptus, picaridin, or IR3535 to your exposed skin. Invasive Aedes mosquitoes are small. They're black and white with stripes on the legs and back, and they bite during the day. If you suspect you have them on your property, call the County Vector Control, and again, that number is 858-694-2888. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.